Hello,
Hello,
Tim.
Tim.
Carl, good morning.
Ah, good
Good
to
to
hear your
hear your
voice.
voice. It's good to hear yours as well.
Welcome
Welcome
back
back
to A Life
to A
in
Life in
Riverview.
Riverview. Thank you for having me.
We're going
We're
to be
going to be
talking
talking
about
about
Hemingway's
Hemingway's
your
real
book.
world.
So
So
maybe we'll
maybe we'll
start
start
by
by
your saying
saying
something
something
about
about
how you got
how you got
interested in
interested in
her
her
and in
and
writing
in
the
writing
book.
the book. Sure. I come from a legal background, as you know, and I studied law at King's College, Cambridge, the home of literary luminaries like E.M. Forster and Rupert Brooke. And King's College didn't really specialize in lawyers, so most of my friends were literary types or musicians. After a lengthy legal career, including being a law professor and dean of a law faculty and a chief federal negotiator resolving land claims and doing out-of-court settlements concerning indigenous people, I decided that I would begin writing something seriously. I'd written many legal pieces, but I wanted to try something different. And I was looking around for a possible subject. I had written two earlier pieces, one concerning my seven great uncles in the First World War, and another piece involving Aline Mosby, the journalist who was the first woman admitted to Soviet Russia, and who, of course, did an expose, quite a dramatic piece on your subject, Marilyn Monroe.
Yes.
Yes.
So I was looking about and I read Mary Hemingway's memoir, How It Was. And that book captured me. It was a sparkling account of her life before and after she met Ernest. However, scholars had dismissed Mary for writing a self-serving biography, for lacking self-awareness and merely living on the surface. She was scorned as the lowest born of the four wives. And they said that she failed to analyze Ernest because she was too shallow to do so, and that she was a mere caretaker wife. Or your other subject, Martha Gellhorn, as you know, went so far as to call her a maggot of history. The more I researched, I found myself reacting against these cruel and, I thought, inaccurate claims. I found that Mary was from a good family, that she was brave, disciplined, intelligent, an excellent writer, and that she understood Ernest Hemingway as well as anyone possibly could. So Mary appeared to me to be a deeper, more profound person than the critics said, and an admirable woman who had succeeded as a journalist in a man's world in wartime. The story I found reading her correspondence, journals, diaries, and interviewing the people who knew her led me to believe that her story deserved to be told, not only to correct the record, but to allow readers to truly meet and make up their minds about this strong woman. Now, I read and enjoyed Paula MacLean's fictional account of Ernest's first wife, Hadley Richardson, the Paris wife, and I believed that anyone who enjoyed Hadley's story would be fascinated by Mary's life. Hadley was married to Ernest for 5 years at the beginning of his writing career. And for 17 years, Mary was Ernest's wife and collaborator and witnessed his success when he won the Pulitzer and Nobel Prizes. And of course, she also saw his decline and tried to save him from alcohol, depression, and suicide. Mary survived Ernest for 25 years and shaped his literary legacy. And Mary's story is the bookend to Hadley's life with the young Hemingway. The book was published in June 2022, and I was very lucky to receive many favorable reviews. One of the highlights, Carl, was your own review in the New Criterion. I felt that I'd been read and understood, and that you contributed to the understanding of the complex relationship between Mary and Ernest.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
It was a great, really, I felt that there was sort of an intellectual connection in it, which I really appreciated because you don't always get that in reviews, as you know. I had another good review in the Hemingway Review by Hilary Justice, the Hemingway scholar in residence at the John F. Kennedy Library and Archives, and Kitty Kelly quipped that this review is beyond phenomenal. Your own mother couldn't have better praised your work. So, I felt that I had succeeded, at least insofar as I wasn't disregarded as a non-Hemingway scholar, because I certainly wasn't. I was coming in from the outside, and as you well know, there are many Hemingway scholars and many formidable people who have worked in the field for years. I was a bit shy about intruding, but my friend Stoney Stoneback, invited me to come in. He read early versions of my work and encouraged me, and ultimately wrote a really astounding preface to the work. So that is sort of how I became interested in Mary's story and how I came to write about her.
That preface is remarkable. That many biographies have prefaced. How did that come about?
Well, because I was an outsider, I thought that it would be useful if someone from Hemingway country could introduce me. I had met Stoney in 2016 at the Hemingway conference in Chicago. He was then president of the society, and he was far too busy to speak with me. I asked him whether it would be possible for us to have a chat, but he was simply too busy. He said, send me an email. So I did later. And then he asked me to send a few samples of my writing. I sent him a couple of pieces I'd written and a draft chapter of one of the chapters from the book I was trying to work on. And he replied with very encouraging words. And over the next few years, he helped me. He introduced me to people in Hemingway country, to Valerie Hemingway, for example. He introduced me to Bonifacio Brass, the person who currently owns and runs the Locanda Cipriani on Torcello, which I think was an important scene, which Ernest and Mary visited and which helped him to set his novel Across the River and Into the Trees. And over the years, Stoney invited me to various Hemingway events and conferences and took a real interest in my work. And when I was troubled by things, I would write to him and he would sort of help me look at things. When it became time to publish the book, I thought that it would be useful if I could have someone like Stoney do a preface. And I was hesitant to ask him because I know how busy he was. And I was absolutely delighted when he agreed to do it. And then I was frankly blown away by the work he did. It was a terrific insight into Mary and his own relationship with her, and highly complimentary about my work.
It's sort of like the first review of your biography.
Yeah, I was stunned when I received it, and my daughter told me, "Dad, enjoy this because it couldn't possibly get any better." And I think she was right. I mean, it really was incredible. And Stoney and I were both very excited because Mary was the first woman to be invited to join the Lotus Club in New York, and she then sponsored Stoney's membership in 1978. And the Lotus Club, when they learned about my book, invited me to come and speak because she was an important person in their club history. And I asked Stoney if he would introduce me as a member of the club, and he agreed. And in late December, we were texting back and forth. He told me, you won't believe this, but I'm actually staying at the Lotus Club, and I was talking to the director of programming last night, and everyone's very excited about your coming here and speaking about the book. And he said, "And I look forward to seeing you here because we'll drink a glass of wine under the portrait of my friend Mark Twain."
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 days later, Stoney died. It was just tragic. He told me in his last email that he was suffering from some form of COVID or flu flurry, and that it even hurt to type the words. Mm-hmm. And then he died. It was, to me, it was a huge loss because you know, we've grown to be quite close over the years. We exchanged our stories and writing and travel ventures and so on. And anyway, his preface was astounding, and I'm of course eternally grateful to him for that.
And you, the result, you had to read his preface in your audio.
Yeah, I felt that was a bit awkward because it would have been better, obviously, if Stoney had read it, and that wasn't possible. And it didn't seem, it may have been possible to get someone else to do it, but I just did it, and I felt awkward doing it.
I think it does the job. Let's talk about the audio blog and how it came about and why you decided to do it.
Okay, well, first of all, I think on audiobooks generally, apparently the global audiobooks market size was valued at $5 billion in 2022. And it's expected to expand at an annual average growth rate of 26% going through to 2030. So my agent persuaded me that we ought to participate in this growing market. And I think that I really had not personally listened to many audiobooks before, but I can see now that they are a convenient way to consume literature while people are multitasking or engaging in other activities such as commuting, exercising, or doing household chores.
That's me.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And I've started doing it myself when I'm driving. And of course, listeners can enjoy a book without having to set aside dedicated time for reading. And for individuals with visual impairments or reading difficulties, which characterize a large number of older people, I think, it's possible to use audiobooks as an accessible alternative to printed or digital text, allowing a wider audience to enjoy literature. So Sam talked to me about this and persuaded me that we really ought to seriously consider doing an audiobook. Now, my wife also played a role in this because she has listened to many audiobooks over the years, and she persuaded me that I should give it a try. She told me that those books read by their authors seemed more authentic and believable, and I listened to several and I enjoyed them. I used to host a radio program, and my producer was a wonderful man who had reported from Europe for CBC Radio. Guy Vaughan had a deep, gravelly voice, perhaps made even deeper by cigarette smoking and whiskey drinking. He was a wonderful teacher. He would interrupt from the control booth, "Timmy boy boy, can you say that again? Remember, breathe from your diaphragm." So given this studio experience, the idea of reading my book did not seem that far-fetched. One day, my agent, Sam Hyatt, sent me a note reporting on a lunch he had in New York with an agent for Tantor Media. As their website says, founded in California in 2000, Tantor Audio has grown from a three-person operation into a leading independent audiobook publisher, producing more than 100 new titles every month. They were interested in licensing my book and producing it as an audiobook. Their website lists some 1,200 narrators, and I listened to several of them. Many of them were talented, but I couldn't find just the right voice for my book. Ultimately, I decided I would do the book myself. The license agreement paid in advance and gave me, as the author, the first option to narrate, the terms of which were to be covered under a separate performer agreement. In any event, I retained the right to select the narrator, and I picked myself. Tantor wanted me to do the recording in an approved studio in the U.S., and I considered doing it in Seattle, which is a two-hour ferry ride away from my home. However, the more I thought about it, the less attractive it became. I'm not a professional voice actor, and I knew I would have trouble reading 6 or 7 hours a day to justify studio space. And I didn't think it would make financial sense to spend several weeks in Seattle. I proposed recording the book in my own sound studio. There was a small problem. I didn't have a sound studio, so I decided to build one. Tantor sound engineers would have to decide if the recording quality met their standards. Now, I found the Tantor folks were helpful, but understandably concerned about maintaining quality. So I watched a number of YouTube videos about voice recording and very quickly decided that I did not want to do the job in a closet filled with pillows and duvets. apparently some authors have done this, but it didn't appeal to me. Also, I'm a bit of a handyman and I like the idea of building my own studio. I talked to friends who are producers of musical recordings and watched more YouTube videos. So I built a sound studio on one side of my attached double garage. It's a small room, 7 feet long by 5 feet wide, sitting on rubber floor tiles and isolated from the structure of the house, so no sound can be transmitted through the floors or walls. And if you'd like a little technical description, I'm happy to give it. The studio is constructed on a 2x4 frame. The walls and roof are made of 5/8 drywall, 3/4 inch sonopan, which is a sound absorbing material that comes in 4x8 sheets, rock wall insulation between the studs, and another layer of sonopan and drywall on the interior. The walls and roof are about 8 inches thick. The interior is covered with sound absorbing panels and baffles, and there's a 6-ply window and the door closes tightly. I built an air exchanger which circulates the air in the otherwise airtight room. The basic idea is to create a space free from outside noise, and the sound absorbing panels on the inside soften the sound so it doesn't sound too harsh. So the studio is wired for internet and electricity and has a built-in desk. I did quite a bit of work researching sound equipment, and I settled on this configuration. I use a Dynamic Shure SM7B microphone that feeds through a Tube MP preamp to a Focusrite controller that converts the analog microphone signals to digital signals that are fed into an Apple Mac Mini, which operates Logitech sound software. The Logitech software is incredibly powerful, and I have mastered only the basic functions. It's used by professional music producers to mix multi-track sound recordings. After I finished the studio, I sent a sample digital file to the sound engineers at Tantor. They approved the studio, and that was a great relief, I can tell you, because it was a bit of a gamble. Now, the studio works well. It eliminates neighborhood sounds, aircraft noise, and the barking of our two Boston Terriers. I use it for Zoom calls, and it has been useful in my legal work when I have interviewed witnesses and conducted hearings over Zoom. I use the studio to teach a course at the 92nd Street Y, and other authors are now contacting me to learn about the process. So that's really what I did.
Well, I think when I describe this podcast, I'm going to call it a podcast and instruction manual.
Well, I'd be happy to share what I learned with others. If anyone is interested, I'd be quite happy to give them a hand.
So how long did it take you to produce the book?
Well, at first I was tentative, and I practiced with the equipment and the text. Tantor sent a PDF of the text they wished me to use, which was only slightly altered from the published manuscript. So I sent recordings of practice sessions to friends who produce vocal music, and their feedback was constructive and basically positive. So I began reading the book from the beginning. I learned to correct errors as I went along, rereading a sentence if I wasn't happy with it. I began to enjoy myself as I realized that I was essentially performing the book. When I was writing the book, I imagined how sentences would sound, and I often read them out loud to myself, or read them out loud in my mind. And I think many writers do this. They structure sentences to be read a certain way. And when I came to read the book, I was able to put my intention into practice, and I enjoyed it, though it was tiring. I found I could do 1 to 3 chapters a day, but then I was really tired. My voice was tired, and I was tired from concentrating. I found that I had to really try hard not to simply read it as a dry document, but to try to inject life in it. It took me about 5 weeks, working most days, to complete the project. I had spent hours and days editing the written material, and I felt reasonably satisfied when I came to read it. After I was finished, I uploaded the digital files to Tantor, and their sound engineers reviewed the book. They listened carefully and found a number of errors, or pickups, as they call it in the business, and Tantor sent a spreadsheet identifying the passages to be re-recorded, and I finished them in a couple of days. The engineers replaced the faulty passages and produced the finished recording. I must say I was very impressed with the attention that Tantor gave to the digital files. They caught things that I had missed, and all of their catches were good ones, and I think improved the quality of the products. I was very impressed with their professionalism throughout the process.
It's kind of like doing retakes on a movie set.
Well, you would know about that. You're an actor.
Well, yeah, although I haven't done movies, but certainly studying film, I'm aware of this need to read a report.
Yeah, what I found was that, you know, initially I would read and then I would go back and listen to a couple of paragraphs. And if I found something I didn't like, it was actually quite difficult to go back in and splice in a change in exactly the right spot with the right phrasing, with the right spacing between words and all that sort of thing. So I found it was much more efficient to simply go back if I didn't like a sentence. So I began listening more carefully as I was going along. And if I didn't like anything about a sentence, I would simply go in and re-record it. And that was actually quite simple, although it was, you know, fairly laborious. But I felt that I was able to control the process better that way.
What did you do with Mary's voice?
Well, you know, one of the things that I learned through the research I did before I got started was that unless the professional actors say, unless you are really good at accents and so on, it's a mistake to try and do accents or female voices, for example, because it just won't sound good. It'll sound bad. And instead, they suggest changing the tone or the cadence. And that's what I tried to do with Mary. I mean, I had a number of different voices in this, Mary's voice, Ernest's voice, Buck Lanham's voice, Carlos Baker's voice, quite a few voices. And I just tried to change them somewhat in terms of cadence or tone. And I didn't try anything overly dramatic. I hope it works. I just felt that to try and create a new voice for Mary was beyond my theatrical skill set. And it would have sounded corny, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. So did your book seem different to you after reading it aloud?
It did in a way. I mean, what I found about it as I got into it was that I found the reading to be quite rewarding. I enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed, bringing what I meant to bring to those words in reading it. And I found, I thought it was quite well done, frankly. I mean, there were some things that I would have changed if I'd thought that I was going to be reading it. Just as one little example, when you read a book, a manuscript, you see the quotation marks and you can tell when something is quoted. And therefore, you sort of pay different attention to it, you know. But it's harder to create that effect when reading it, so that when I listen to the work that I've recorded, sometimes it's difficult to tell when something is a quotation and is not. So that was a difference, I think, that I was surprised by.
Yeah. Did you pause to sort of indicate the quotation?
Well, I did sort of pause, but I'm not sure that it always worked. And that was one of the things I noted in reviewing it.
So are you now in business as an audio narrator?
I don't think so. But I have a number of people have contacted me, and I'm helping people to do their setup and encouraging them to do it, really. I mean, I think everyone should do it. It's really interesting to hear the author reading it. One of my friends joked with me, okay, your voice is all right, but why don't you get Tom Hanks to do it? I said, well, I'd be happy to do that, but I don't know him. Perhaps if you could send me his email, I can make a connection. So there are clearly actors who do a brilliant job reading these books. But I think that it's very interesting to hear the author do it. And I've now started listening for that. And so I would encourage people to give it a try. It's another creative act in the project. And for example, I think you would be fantastic. I think I told you once that one of my wife's friends thinks you have a very sexy voice, and you could very easily and profitably read some of your material. It would take you a long time because you have so much.
Yeah. The problem is I'm not handy, so I can't build my own studio, and I'm not close to studio.
Huh.
So I can't. It's at least a couple hours away.
Yeah, that's hard. One of the things I found that was good about having my own was that I could quit when I wanted. I didn't have a producer.
Yes.
Who was sort of hanging on my words, or I didn't have to be considerate about anybody else. So I was just able to do it when I wanted and quit when I got tired. And that is, at least for, you know, an amateur like myself, an important consideration. And also, since it's right in my home, it wasn't a big problem to commute to it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Carl, maybe you'll just have to come here and stay in our guest suite and record a couple of things in the studio.
Yeah.
Longer than you'd like.
well, it's been a pleasure. Is there something else I should have asked you?
No, I think those were good questions. I might just say that the nicest surprise about doing it was that my 44-year-old son has been listening to it. And he told me that it made him feel like the little boy he was when I read to him every night. And then over the holidays, he told me that he felt that he'd been in conversation with me. You know, so the recording makes the book a living legacy for those who love you. And it's an interesting, I found it a very interesting adventure.
Yeah. Marvelous. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Carl. Really a pleasure to speak with you.
I will post this and send you a link.
Thanks very much, Carl. You take care.
You too.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.